You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Good afternoon, everybody. I am Elizabeth Oldfield and I'm your chair for today. I'm the director of Theos and it's a real pleasure to welcome you here. And I'm just going to say a few brief words about our speaker, but I imagine that you as an audience today are fairly well prepped on who Christa is. As you know, she's the presenter of On Being, a Peabody Award-winning broadcaster and a recipient of the President's National Humanities Medal. She was born in Oklahoma, studied history at Brown, and was awarded a Fulbright scholarship, which took her to Germany. She spent several years there working as a foreign correspondent for the New York Times, among others, in divided Berlin, and then did a career change to become chief aide to the US ambassador to West Germany. Later, she studied divinity at Yale and began working on a radio project based on religion in the late 1990s, which would eventually become On Being. In 2013, she started a non-profit production company, which she describes as a social enterprise with a radio show at its heart. Now, this is one of my more daunting assignments as a chair. Part of the reason On Being is so widely loved and listened to is Christa's skill as an interviewer. Not the skill that we think of in many of our journalists, often confrontational, browbeating someone into revealing something that they'd rather not, but the skill of someone panning for gold. Central to her approach is generous listening, a deep curiosity about other human beings, and the need to ask better questions. So I really hope I will be able to do even half as good a job as Christa might do, were it possible for her to interview herself. Please join me in welcoming Christa. Christa, we'll start with an easy, not a simple one. What made you want to write about wisdom, and what does it mean to you?
So I didn't. So first of all, I just want to say what a thrill it is to be here, because you know, podcasting makes the world open up. It's changed radio, and I knew there were people listening in the UK, but now I really believe it. I didn't actually set out to write about wisdom. I was following a question I have been asked across the years from the very beginning of doing the show, where people wanted to know what are the recurring themes in these lives of grace and beauty, and I also was following a phrase of Einstein, not one of his most famous quotes, but one that I was very taken with. That he, you know, he actually, Einstein, if he had a faith, it was in the scientific enterprise, and he really believed that science would be the human discipline that would transcend national boundaries and tribal rivalries. And then, in the early and mid-century, he watched scientists become creators of weapons of mass destruction. He was very taken with Gandhi, his contemporary, and he said at one point that he had come to believe that that lives like Gandhi and Jesus and Buddha and Moses, and he loved St. Francis of Assisi, that this was spiritual genius, genius in the art of living, and that the security and dignity and joy of the future of humanity needed this kind of genius as much as it needed the purveyors of objective knowledge. But I found that as I was tracing the idea of spiritual genius, that also felt so lofty. And one of my problems about the way we talk about saints is that, you know, or good people, is we put them up on a pedestal, and if they appear in the newspaper, they're usually in some fluffy sidebar, and it's a story of somebody who you could never be like. So as I was really culling through this, all this material of my years of conversation, it was this quality of wisdom that kept rising up, and also the realization that wisdom is accessible to all of us, and that it emerges through the raw materials of our lives. And so it was a process by which I named that as what I was pursuing, and that as something that weaves all as a possibility through all kinds of lives at all places on the spectrum of a lifetime, mm-hmm. and that it's there for public life as well as individual life.
And have you found that the word resonates? Because I feel like we've maybe lost the language of wisdom.
Of wisdom. Yeah, it's... I'm very concerned, as you know, in the book, I'm very attentive to all the words we ruin. I think wisdom is a lucky one because we don't use it very much.
Yeah.
And so it's not really watered down. It's a little bit unexpected.
Yeah.
But it has integrity. It's very ecumenical and respectable to all kinds of people. I'm finding it language that people are enjoying.
Yeah.
I also like the language of virtues, you know?
Yeah.
And with that one, I find, and as really tools for the art of living, and with that one, I do find that people over a certain age, that the language of virtues is really loaded for them. That it's, you know, these were the things that were foisted on us.
Yeah.
And things you could fail at. But I find that younger people find that language of virtues very magnetic as practical tools, right? Like spiritual technologies to pin aspiration to action.
Yeah. So I know lots of people today will be a bit like me in that we love listening to you put other people in the limelight. And I'm always interested perhaps by what you're thinking, but I don't want to do that in a very confrontational way, because I know for a journalist it can be a bit scary to suddenly be the subject. But what are those spiritual technologies, what are the virtues and the values that you personally have found helped you on your path to wisdom?
Yeah, you're right. That's my least favorite question.
No, I'm sorry.
So I describe myself, I mean, I'm theologically educated, but I got a theological education after living in, after being a thoroughly political person, working diplomatically in divided Berlin in the 1980s in that vanished world. I was surprised to find myself taking religion seriously in the world and in myself. And so I studied theology to test that and to know that I could, that it could involve the life of the mind, mm-hmm. that it could address the complexity of the world.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, what I say about... So I am theologically educated. That flows into what I do. I found that a fantastic discipline for then moving way beyond Christianity, because I went to a Christian seminary. I say that my mother tongue in my homeland is Christianity. And, you know, the texts, the rituals, the traditions... that remains true. At this particular moment in my life, I'm not very officially active in that. I still think that I understand that as defining. I have a very serious practice of yoga, mm-hmm. which is, and I don't do very spiritual yoga. I do hot, sweaty, athletic yoga. But at this point in my life, and this is in the book too. I mean, I talk about the body, right?
Mm-hmm.
So at this point in my life, I understand getting out of my head and into my body to be spiritually important.
Mm.
And I actually believe that somehow the extent to which we are planted in our bodies and our physical selves, in all their flaws and all their grace, also determines how spiritual we are able to be.
Mm.
That's kind of a mystery I hold. You know, I'm a reader. I have a very modest meditation practice, which I don't even talk about very much in public, because it's all I can do. I do 6 minutes while my tea steeps in the morning. So, you know, I think I'm a very modern person, and that I'm availing myself of these traditions of the ages, which are so accessible to us now. But I also don't think I dabble.
Yeah. It was one of the things that was tremendously refreshing about the book, and your chapter on faith is, I don't know if you noticed this, is longer than all of the others, and complex and rich.
It is complex, yeah.
Yeah. Oh,
and to rewrite it.
Wonderful. Mm-hmm. And the quote that stood out to me is you talked about, in your kind of context of being reasonably positive about religion, about the deep savvy about hope that religion tends, mm-hmm. and its seriousness about the common experience of mystery.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think either of those are in the public narrative about what religion is and what it might offer. What could be done? Can anything be done to tell that story better?
I don't think it's in the public narrative that mystery is something we get to take seriously. I think that we have worked so hard. We worked so hard through the 20th century to bracket mystery out.
Yeah.
And we want to create markets and workplaces and political systems that are rational. This is a good wish. Yeah. It's reasonable, but it's not possible because we are still dealing with the human condition. We are dealing with the mystery of ourselves and the mystery of the other. Mm-hmm. And we're at this moment right now, in the States as here, where with all of our sophistication, I feel like somehow our sophistication has brought us to this point where we are faced back with ourselves. I do think of mystery as a common human experience. You don't have to be talking about religion. You don't have to be talking about God to acknowledge that there is mystery in being born, there is mystery in loving, there is mystery in dying. And I do think that if you extend this to public life now, you know, the mystery of the other, we have to grapple with that. And it's not going to, it's messy. It's not going to be something that we can just do with facts and reason and logic. Mm-hmm. So what I value in our religious traditions is that they have always acknowledged this thing, this reality. To be reality based about anything, to take mystery seriously is a way of being reality based. But that's counterintuitive in the 21st century.
Yeah. So it's a tremendously hopeful book and tremendously realistic about the challenge facing us. And I've been really looking forward to today. I think many people have, because certainly in the UK, and I gather in the States as well, it feels like an incredibly tribal, tumultuous moment in our common life, which is the phrase that you use, which I really like, perhaps more than our public life. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me this allergy to mystery, this grasping after control, this grasping after certainty is a lot of what's going on. But you're quite hopeful about the fact this might be an opportunity to readdress the human condition for us to essentially grow up, to mature into being able to stay in mystery and uncertainty. Yes. I think we could all just do with hearing why you think that.
Well, I write, Thierry de Chardin, the paleontologist, Jesuit paleontologist of the last century, is kind of a beacon for me. And he was uncovering the proof of human physical evolution, and looking at fossil evidence of how primitive we had been physiologically, and imagining people a few hundred years or thousands of years from now seeing us spiritually as also primitive. You know, I'm very drawn to this idea that we are in the adolescence of our species. And that the globe right now looks like the pictures we can take of the teenage brain, which is to say these areas of brilliance flashing up, of new possibilities, of creativity, of advance that wasn't even imaginable a few years ago, and that coexisting in a very unsettled way with unparalleled recklessness and destructive potentials. So I do think that the task is to grow ourselves up, and that it requires that we see ourselves whole, and that we take on, you know, this phrase, "He who doesn't know history is doomed to repeat it." It's not true. What we know in life, and this applies on the magnified canvas that is our public life, is that until we know ourselves, we are doomed to repeat. Until we know ourselves, we are doomed to repeat. We will repeat the same mistakes over and over again. And that means grappling with ourselves differently. I mean, look, I follow the Brexit vote and all the dynamics here so closely, and there are these, you know, there are very different dynamics, but analogous things happening in the States with our presidential election. And at root, what is vexing us, what is making all of our best systems unstable is raw human pain and fear. And we haven't addressed that. We haven't wanted to see it. And even if we care about it, we wanted to think that we could come up with the right systems and solutions. And we have to address it directly. We have to let that be some of our work in public. And this is another thing we know in our individual lives as we grow up, as we become capable of not repeating the same mistakes over and over again. You only move beyond being defined by those things when you let them be in the room, when you dwell with that pain, when you take it seriously, when you walk with it. That's the only way you walk through the other side. And we have to do some kind of analogous work. I like the language of common life because I worry in the States, and I think it may be true here as well, that the language of public life, we've narrowly equated in our imaginations with political life. But public life, common life, includes political life, but it's so much bigger. And it includes the fullness of ourselves, not just as citizens, but as parents and friends and neighbors, professional people, people with avocations, artists.
That piece about really, I guess, the brokenness of the human condition, which is something that religion and spirituality is perhaps best at, just looking straight in the face.
Yes, it's the place where that's what we do.
Yeah, but it's not something we're trained into as we go into common life, as we progress through our careers. Yeah. And I found the Brené Brown and others in your book talking repeatedly about vulnerability, about transparency. Do you see anyone actually modelling that in public? And if not, how can we be a group of peers who encourage it?
Well, you know, one thing I was hastened to add, I mean, there are these things we're discovering right now in our advanced age that are actually not new, but they're primal truths that we forgot, like that food should be real is one of them. We were having to undo 50 years of progress. And another thing we're learning is that vulnerability is that life is ephemeral, that we are, this is one reason I'm so much about honoring our bodies, because our bodies will always tell us the truth that our minds deny, that we, you know, alongside all of our strength, we have frailty. We are soft and we're searching and we need others. So, and in the States, what's happening with this? So we're rediscovering that vulnerability is part of the human condition. And what's happening in the States, this is so American, is there's now this whole genre of mostly business books, and it's about failure, that failure is inevitable on the way to success, right? So these are all books about how I succeeded because I embraced failure. So that's half the truth. But what are, you know, something I so appreciate in religious tradition is what our spiritual traditions say is, in the midst of vulnerability, in the midst of things going wrong, as they always do, right there, there is meaning to be found. There is growth that is possible. It may seem perverse. It's certainly paradoxical that human life works this way, but it does work this way, that what goes wrong for us is almost always an opening to coming out the other side stronger in a different way, wiser.
The hope is a function of struggle. That putting it in its...
We're at this moment collectively now. But I mean, it's a terrible thing to be in this position, but what choice do we have but to decide in this moment that we must let it be an opening to becoming wiser? And part of that is we have to accompany each other in that. I mean, you know, this Americans are so individualistic, and I'm afraid that that's kind of a virus that has spread. That's a lie, you know. That's not the truth of us or how we advance or how we can be healthy.
And I don't know about you, but I talk about it sometimes in the media or at events that we do. I talk about hope, and it feels like there's a vulnerability even in daring to talk about hope. You called it a calling for those of us who can hold it.
Yes.
So I'm always aware when I'm trying to talk about hope of how soft it seems. If you can hear this, I can hear people rolling their eyes. Mm-hmm. So, how do we frame hope as something more than just a kind of slightly irritating wet concept.
Right. Yeah, well, I distinguish between hope and optimism. I really don't like the word optimism. For me, it's not about wishful thinking. It's about a reality base, choosing to look reality square in the face, to see the darkness, to see what is wrong and flawed and broken. And also that part will be better publicized, but look for the whole spectrum of the truth. Hope is a far more daring, courageous, risky orientation. Mm-hmm. Cynicism is easy. It's lazy. It's never surprised when things go wrong and will never lift a finger to change them. It's very much the easy option, yeah. The fashionable easy option. Yeah. It's not doing us any good,
yeah.
Right? What are we about contributing to this moment in time, bringing the fullness of ourselves? I mean, I love what we're learning through neuroscience about what we practice, we become. And that goes for skills or professional abilities or athletic abilities, but it also goes for virtues. It goes for deciding to move through the world as a more patient, kind, loving. I mean, you choose your virtue you'd like. We don't have to be born with these as talents. And if you're born with any talent, you still have to develop it. You have to practice it. And hope, to me, is a choice that can become a habit. I mean, again, habits are things we do not do perfectly the first time, and we have to keep practicing them. But a choice that becomes a habit, that becomes spiritual muscle memory. It's an orientation. It's a way to move through reality and say yes. Like, see what is broken, and say yes and see also in the spectrum of human possibility and societal possibility, we're very close to home. You can be part of healing, repair, just offering kindness. I feel like at this particular moment in time in America, and I suspect this is probably true here too, there's a calling for some of us, and this isn't as big as the calling that we've grown up with, save the world, right, change the world. There's a really urgent calling for some of us just to be calmers of fear. Because fear comes out in public looking like anger. Mm-hmm. You said a minute ago, how can we encourage vulnerability? The thing is, we all have some work to do in encouraging vulnerability in public, because we don't reward politicians for showing vulnerability, for saying they changed their mind. And all of us have followed that cue. Mm. So people who are on the losing side of the equations of modernity, everybody knows, we're all trained to do outrage. We're trained to do that. That's what gets taken seriously in public. We haven't created trustworthy spaces to give voice to our pain and our fear and feel it acknowledged.
So that might be part of the answer to my next question, which is one that I have been wrestling around in my head, particularly in the last few weeks, but really for a while, in that the UK feels like it's a moment of crisis of leadership, a crisis of wisdom across the spectrum. Mm-hmm. So in the last little while, but also we've had scandals in banking, in politics, in the charity sector, in the church, in sport, it goes on. All our major institutions have revealed themselves to have some pretty serious fault lines at the heart of them.
Right.
And I feel in a previous generation we might have expected part of the role of a leader of that kind of institution to be wisdom. And I don't yet, I think particularly since the crises, we don't expect that anymore. So I guess I'm asking...
And that's very stressful for us, for human beings.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's the kind of where have all the grown-ups gone
feeling. I know. And the good news and the bad news is we have to be them.
Okay.
Really, yeah. Because it's not the places we want to be looking for that leadership. Those are the most dysfunctional places among us.
And is that something about... we spoke briefly about cultural liturgies. I know we've talked about the kind of neuroplasticity of these practices. Mm-hmm. Is it something about the way, in Catholic terms, the formation of character that you get going through those institutions into public life and common life, that is not the fruit of that is not wisdom? And how might we adjust them so it could be?
I'm sure that that adjustment will happen over the next couple of generations. I actually think that who we have in power now is kind of, there's a huge lag between the generation that is now on top and the world we inhabit. And, you know, I find it helpful and kind of calming to take a really long view of time and to realize that we are turn of century people and to see that. And I don't think some of what's going on is not that it's simple, but apart from anything else, our technology, the forms of our technology, have completely upended the meaning of basic things like making and leading and belonging. Mm-hmm. I mean, authority is never going to be the same again. And in this picture, I mean, it's a very unsettling moment where we look at all of our institutions, and I really think all of our institutions, as they came out of the 20th century, they just are inadequate at best and nonsensical at worst. You know, the way schools function, the way prisons function, workplaces, and politics. So that's a very... You know, 100 years ago, though... 100 years ago here, right, exactly 100 years ago, you had real enemies. You had real enemies, and you had a real crisis. And it was very defined, and the enemies were uniforms. Yeah. And the crisis, you could draw it on a map. And what we have is, you know, I liken it to a reformation, but this time it's a reformation of every single institution, and it's brought about by our technology as much as anything else. Mm-hmm. So all of our systems, they suddenly don't make sense. And so we are in this very stressful, I mean, physiologically stressful position of not having a clear enemy, of not having a clear crisis, but of having to recreate reality kind of step by step. And I think it can help to realize that that this is a long-term project. Mm-hmm. I think it can help to decide to work very close to home. Like, what small piece of this picture can I be generative and creative and can I accompany others in fashioning new forms that make sense for now? And I think the more we are looking to our leaders, as in previous generations, the more frustrated and helpless we will feel. Mm-hmm. We do have to be the grown-ups in the room.
Good news, everybody. Need to go home and train up. I want to loop back to this difference thing, because I feel like it's underneath a lot of things at the moment. And we've spoken a bit about Jonathan Sacks' concept of the dignity of difference, of that space in between raw tribalism and such a fear of difference that we homogenize and we push differences down and we try and pretend that they're all the same. So that holding together particularity and unity, it feels like there was perhaps a few decades where we were kind of doing okay at it in a few Western European countries, and something has caused that fear, that fight or flight, that shutting down of difference because it unsettles us, and to kick back in. Would you have any guess at what might have been the seeds of that?
Well, again, a long view of time is helpful, because if you just think that really it's only been about 50 years in the West, that of course there was diversity before, right? But it's only about 50 years ago that we started integrating this into our sense of self in the West. And I think what we did in the States is we called tolerance, and what you did here is you called multiculturalism. And it was very new. It was very new, and we were trying to keep it safe. Mm-hmm. And I just think we started making baby steps. But now, again, we live in this globalized world, and those early attempts have come full circle, and you have new generations who want more than to be tolerated, or to have a, you know, this thing we you know, celebrating diversity, as you say, generally meant focusing on what we have in common and doing something pretty superficial, not really engaging the interesting depths where, in fact, we're very different. Mm-hmm. So there's a great civil rights leader who just died last year, Vincent Harding, who I've interviewed a couple of times. And he said, when it comes to being, he said this about America, but I think it's true of Western Europe as well, when it comes to being a multi-religious, multi-ethnic, whatever the other multis would be, democracy, we are a developing nation. We've only been at this for 50 years. That's actually a helpful perspective. Yeah. But from my perspective, the frontier we're on now is, this is a fait accompli. But tolerance and multiculturalism, which is kind of everybody keeping in their place, we have outlived that, the usefulness of that. And the task now is, you know, really how to engage difference, how to live together. And I think how to actually live together, having lost the illusion, which was not reality-based, that we're all going to agree or somehow become more alike, yeah, and that would be progress. Yeah. We are different, and our particularities are our gift to the world. Yeah. And so now, at this more advanced stage, we have to figure out, you know, what we've always done. I mean, here, you know, the debate, right? This is what we do in the West. We debate, and we believe that you can have this way of thinking or being, and that way of thinking and being, and somehow you can pit them against each other, and then you will call the debate, and there will be a winner. And the world isn't going to ever work that way again, if it ever did before. We have to figure out how to grapple with the challenges of this century, of the environment, and, you know, and the environment which has to do with refugees. I mean, we have these huge challenges, and we are going to have to walk into them with our best wisdom, in conversation with other people with whom we disagree and from whom we are very different. And it's not even about finding common ground. For me, I think one thing I want to encourage us to do is find common questions, right? Very focused on having the same answers. Mm-hmm. But across any spectrum on any issue, what we do in the States is we set up the most strident voices on both sides of the issue and they steal all the oxygen from the room and they demoralize all the rest of us about what's possible. But across that spectrum, right up to this pole or that pole, there are other people who have some of the same questions we have. And there are other people who feel passionately about their identity or their convictions, and yet also understand that they have to create the world they want their children to inherit in company with us. And so there's this work of making those connections. And we really are beginners. We have to figure out what this means to create new common spaces where we're not coming together with the same choir, where we're making a different kind of invitation, where we're stepping a little bit outside our comfort zone and creating a trustworthy space where others can step outside theirs. And maybe all we do in the first instance is share our questions. I love Rilke's language about living the questions, which you could not answer now. You could not answer because you could not live them now.
We did a piece of research looking at community organizing, because it's a very interesting space where you have very deep differences. So it's institutions coming together, for those of you who don't know it. So you have the local Catholic parish, the local mosque, the local school, a local union come together and ask what are our common questions about how we make our common lives better. But what they resist doing is saying, in order to work together, We need to agree on everything.
Right.
And in order to work together, we need to be the same. And there's huge fault lines in how those groups conceive of gender or sexuality or, you know, everything. They disagree. They agree on very few things, but they might agree on how to help with knife crime in the area.
Yes.
So our conclusion is one of the ways to deal with differences, you stop applying this progressive test where you say, you know, your views or your perspective puts you in or out of the tent, and we will work with you if you pass the progressive test. And you say, you know what, if you're wanting to serve the common good, we'll work with you even if I find your views abhorrent on this.
Yep.
And do you think there's other spaces where we might be able to see that springing up?
I think that what you're describing is exactly what we have to do. Yeah, if we make common ground a prerequisite for common life, we are impoverishing ourselves, and we're not going to do the work we need to do. But it's a stressful moment where none of this is given to us, and where precisely the opposite of what we're longing for will be modeled in the places we're used to be looking. And
it takes courage.
It takes courage, and it just takes a little bit of. It takes courage, and I think also working with what you know, not feeling like you have to, like it has to be very far away or kind of this mega solution. Working where you can.
It's a very good note on which to open up to what I'm sure is a very engaged and informed audience for your chance to ask Krista some questions. Go ahead.
Lucy Wills, I'm an RSA fellow, and I'm really interested in how much of our culture actually has a religious basis. Mm. And one of the things that that you said really struck a note with me, and you almost seem to skip over it, which is about seeing ourselves whole. And I do wonder whether that's something that we find very difficult, because maybe our coping strategies or our culture gets in the way. And I'd love to hear more about that, if you have any thoughts.
I actually think that a lot of our great foundation of modernity unwittingly divided us up in ways that we're now understanding were wrong. I mean, even something like medicine, the way medicine divided our bodies into parts, and now we're understanding how it's all an ecosystem. And even the language of mind, body, spirit, which, you know, has previously been, you know, was New Agey language. And now we're learning that all of this is interactive, and what we call an emotion is also lodged in neurotransmitters and physiologically. Religion did the same thing. The religion I grew up with was very chin up, frightened of the body. For my Southern Baptist preacher grandfather, body was an entry point of danger, full stop. That was not sustainable. That was not whole. And it did a disservice to it meant, in fact, that we were not able to inhabit those religious teachings in their fullness. And I think the Enlightenment did the same thing, right? Now, what I've come to understand about Descartes more recently is that he actually didn't, you know, when he said, "I think, therefore I am," he was actually trying to carve out a space. You know, this was a world in which the assertion was being made that we would be able to understand everything by mathematics. But the way that came down as kind of an Enlightenment soundbite is that all that matters is what goes on inside your head. So it's funny because there's a similarity between the religious mistrust of the body and an overriding trust in our cerebral possibilities, and actually the same thing happening in the intellectual sphere with a different rationale. So I think in so many ways, and yes, as we start to we are understanding human wholeness on our scientific frontiers in a way that is just, you know, dramatic and fascinating, and we are going to have to incorporate that. That alone will change all of our institutions if we let it, but it's going to take some time.
Thank you. Gentleman here.
I'm Trevor Sanford, also a fellow of the RSA. Just wanted to backtrack to you the last thing you were saying before the questions, which about growing understanding of diversity and mutual understanding in the public domain. I just wonder about the media, whether eventually, you know, even the media will grow up and realize that confrontation is not the best way to get, you know, anything out of people, or whether, you know, it'll take us 100 years and maybe the media will constantly keep us at that confrontational, quick answer, yes, I know what you're thinking, you're going to tell me now, response, or whether, yeah, that's unfair. But you mentioned technology, but I wonder about the media, because if you want to find anywhere that's really grappling with these sort of things, you might get it very late on BBC Two or Radio Four, but otherwise.
Or on me.
So any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think, well, the media is one of these dysfunctional places. I mean, of course, there's a lot of great, there are great people, and there's wonderful work being done, but in terms of how media works for us collectively, you know, the way the news is defined as the extraordinary thing that happened today, but it's generally turned into the extraordinarily terrible thing that happened today. And then in a 24/7 news environment, we are bombarded by that, by those same terrible things all day, all night. And we don't internalize that as extraordinary. We start to internalize this as, this is the norm, this is what we're up against as a species, all is lost, right? And journalists, I'm a journalist, and I went into print journalism, and I think journalists often tend to be very, you know, many journalists are kind of mission-driven people. But that form of journalism has become paralyzing. And of course there's so much media now, but here we are in this moment of where, you know, everything is so new. The internet is in its infancy. I mean, it feels like it's fully formed and it's landed on us, but it in fact is just this very, very young creation. And so I think part of the answer is us understanding that it's up to us to shape the internet to human purposes, and that's work we just have to be doing now. I guess I kind of feel the same way about media that I feel about politics. It will change, but it's going to be slow. And I think there will just be pockets where you see it being done in a way that feels generative, that feels like it's addressing human wholeness.
Hi, yeah, wonderful talk. But we are all adults here, and more or less we have sort of become set in our ways. And I wonder, in terms of education, and there's this spread of education worldwide at all levels, especially at higher education in the developed countries. But all the patterns are set in primary school and in secondary school. And by the time you reach higher education, the pattern has already been set of whether you are going to become wise with age or you're just going to continue the same way. So I ask myself this question. How can things change when the education system sets the standard and it's so deficient for so many?
I wish I had an answer for that. I mean, I have a son who's 17, who's just graduating from high school, and I have a daughter who's a little bit older, and I've lived through, in their lifetime, this 20-year span of education making sense to me. It was what I knew. And just like my son in the last 5 years just saying, they're not teaching us in school what we need to know. And also seeing the inequities between the way, you know, some students get onto the fast track and some don't. And I have to say also, in both of our countries right now, and I know this isn't really what you're asking, but to me it seems relevant that, you know, in both of our countries right now, the gap between in education levels in the Brexit vote and the gap in education levels in who was supporting Donald Trump and who was supporting Hillary Clinton in the U.S. There's something there that we really, really, it's fundamental. We really have to figure that out. I think this is something we just have to walk through, but I have to imagine that the part of the answer is to us be very clear-eyed and be very honest with our children and, you know, as neighbors and as citizens, that we're dealing with substandard conditions here and that we will have to somehow find ways to supplement. It's not, you know, it's just sending our kids to school isn't going to do it anymore, and it isn't going to do it if they are the best schools.
I love your analogy of the adolescent mind and looking at the world right now. And I have an adolescent, so I can really relate. And there's an adolescent inside me, and I think inside all of us. Yeah. I just wanted to hear you talk about that, riff off that idea a little bit more, if that's okay.
Mm-hmm. Did it come to you when you first had a teenager?
No, it actually came to me. It actually came to me in a conversation. I'm extending an idea that I got from other people. It kind of draws out of that Teilhard de Chardin view that. We feel ourselves to be so sophisticated, and we can. There's so much more. We can be so much bigger, so much fuller, so much wiser. I guess another reason I like the word wisdom is because to me, wisdom can have everything to do with intelligence, but it takes it a step farther. And you know, there's information, there's being informed, and there's being discerning. And I feel like those are the steps we get to make now. And that kind of move isn't necessarily cultivated, really, or encouraged. We're not equipped to do that. The adolescence of, you know, the idea, that helps me. That image helps me. For personal reasons. Just look at the last 2 weeks we've had, right? These horrendous moments of violence and recklessness and destructiveness, and the numbers of people who died and who were injured, and yet it was often, you know, one person. And yet we, especially because the way it comes to us in media, we start to feel like, what is the world coming to? And I think somehow, like, engaging our executive function in our brains, for those of us who are fortunate enough to be able, and that's what teenagers have trouble doing, right, is engaging the executive function in their brains. Not to diminish or dismiss how terrible what happened, what has been, but not to extend that as defining of us. We are not defined by the worst that happens, unless we make that imaginative leap and imagine that we are, and then we lose hope and we lose courage. So to me, that is the move, being able to see, to put things into perspective. And I know we're capable of that now. But I feel even with that we have to be in conversation. I keep using this language, we have to accompany each other. Because it's not easy, and a lot of what comes at us defies this move we want to make of growing up.
And I think there's something about a natural hostility and defensiveness of a teenage brain, that when you approach them with compassion and love, despite that, comes slightly. Maybe we need to just assume we'll all be hostile and defensive to begin with, and approach each other with compassion.
Well, yeah. Well, and we could carry this farther. I mean, I think though, of course, parenting is just one long experience of failing in different ways, right? Or feeling like you're failing in different ways. But I feel like one thing at this point, learn to do with my teenagers is not to you hurt for them, and you want to solve it, and you want to fix it, and you can see exactly what they should do. And when they're in pain, you want to tell them that it will be better, and they won't believe you if you do. But what I've realized is what they really need you to be outside that. Embodying the fact that there is life beyond that moment, which when you're that age feels like it is forever. Nothing will ever change. And somehow maybe that's a good analogy for a calling for some of us now to embody the fact that isn't, the worst things are not defining, that there is a reality beyond that we can also all be part of creating.
Hi, Krista. Thank you so much. That was wonderful. One of my favourite episodes of On Being is your conversation with the poet Mary Oliver. And I listened to it kind of in dark times many times in my life. We'll probably all know her question of, so tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? Mm-hmm. And I'm curious to hear how you have decided along the way what to do with your one wild and precious life, from being a foreign correspondent to studying mm-hmm. divinity. If you could talk about the wisdom that's guided you along the way.
How I ended up in this trajectory. I guess to state it as simply as possible. You know, I was in Divided Berlin, and I landed there a bit by being ambitious and good at what I was doing, and also just a lot of luck of being in the right place at the right time and being the New York Times stringer there. And then the last year I was chief aide to our ambassador to West Germany, who was a 38-year-old Reagan appointee. And I knew he was young, but now I really know how young he was. He was a nuclear arms expert. And I found myself at this very young, impressionable age sitting around tables with people who were literally moving those missiles around on a map of Europe, thousands and thousands of missiles. And I experienced, it was exhilarating, it was seductive, but I saw this pretty terrifying gap between the external lives that a lot of these powerful people had and their internal lives, where they were adolescent. And so as that was happening, and I was kind of like, okay, I was on the fast track. I was like, really? This is what I want to be when I grow up? Or are these the people I want to be spending time with when I grow up? At the very same time, I was really engaged and moved by that division of Berlin. It was really a vast social experiment. We never talk about it that way, but it was one people, same history, same language, same culture, split into two competing worldviews. And it was an incredible laboratory for this spiritual insight that that we are not defined by the circumstances that are given to us. So I knew people on the Western side who had everything, who were empty and shallow, wasted their lives. I knew people on the Eastern side who had nothing, and it wasn't material as much as they had no choices, they had no freedom, but they crafted lives of great beauty and dignity. They invested in their intimate spaces. They were so much bigger and more mature and wiser than these nuclear arms experts I was with. And so that kind of put me into a crisis, because I thought politics was where I would make my mark, and I thought that's where one does make a mark. And I found myself feeling like maybe if I really wanted to, you know, in terms of the imprint I wanted to make on the world or where I wanted to be working, that there was that human level that didn't get factored into high politics and strategy, but where actually everything was happening and everything was being determined. So, you know, it's interesting because then in my work has become more and more about this interface between spiritual life and or these spiritual questions and the human condition and public life. So in a way, you know, you see that line, but I never would have predicted it, and it all felt like it kind of happened a bit chaotically.
We've got a Twitter question in, and they wanted to ask what your definition of spirituality would mean, and what's the difference between that and being reflective?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say there is a difference. I actually think that spiritual life is there. I think spiritual life can be very robust in the absence of a belief in God. So I don't think that spiritual life is necessarily connected to religion. I think all these definitions also are really inadequate. And, you know, like the words are inadequate. The word God is the most inadequate of all. So these words are too small for what we're trying to talk about. But I think of spiritual life as the part of life where we are searching, where we are... I do think it's a reflective part of life. I think it is where we are thinking about meaning, thinking about the purposefulness of our lives. And I think it's also the part of us that is there when... in all those moments in life where things are not what they're supposed to be, it wasn't in the plan, when things go wrong, when we face illness, when we face loss, when we grieve, when we love and we lose love, and strangely, you know, none of our other disciplines, except a little bit psychology, but it's not the same. None of our other disciplines are there for us in those moments and saying, yeah, make sense of this. You know, it's not just kind of a soft, it's not just a balm. It's like, make something of this. So to me, that's what spiritual life is. I think atheists have spiritual lives, although I know some atheists don't like that language, and I respect that. But for me, it's not something exclusive. And yet, religious tradition, theology, ritual, community—you know, these have carried across time, a conversation across time about these matters, and text and rituals, which I think human beings just need, whoever they are. I think we really, you know, we lost our sense of that, and our need for community as well. So they accompany and enrich and can inform that. But I also think we're living in this fascinating moment where physicists and evolutionary biologists and neuroscientists are on some of the ground now that that philosophers and theologians were on in previous generations. These questions of what it means to be human and how we create our lives and what is our place in the cosmos, they are informing those common human questions, which are also the animating questions behind religion, as richly as philosophers and theologians have done. So I think spiritual life is evolving, and that's another really fascinating thing about the moment we inhabit.
Krista, thank you so much. We have copies of Krista's book, Becoming Wise, which I would heartily recommend, on the table outside, and I think Krista will be willing to sign some, yeah, some copies for you. Please do stay in touch with the RSA. There's many wonderful events like this that go on to get us all thinking, and thank you so much for your engagement and your wonderful questions.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.